Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 372, I chat with color imaging scientist Jack Holm about high dynamic range. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 21st, 2017. Episode 372, HDR Deep Dive. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Jack Holm, a color scientist and president and CTO of Tarkus Imaging. Hey, Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
So nice to have you here. Those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room from there, or you can go to irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps to put my name, my screen name, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes, somewhere in the message, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen and I will more easily see it. So, Jack, we met at the Samsung QLED and HDR10 seminar a couple months ago here in L.A., and I thought your presentation was really great, and so I wanted to get you on the show to talk about certainly one of my favorite subjects, high dynamic range, or HDR, which is how we'll probably refer to it from here on out. Let's start by sort of defining exactly what it is.
Okay, well, high dynamic range is the ability to display a wider dynamic range, in other words, darker blacks and lighter brights on the screen than we've had before. And it really wasn't possible technically, except with very exotic technology up until fairly recently. So this is a new thing. It's not something anyone's really had to deal with too much before, and it's causing quite a bit of stir as people try to figure out exactly what it is, what to do with it, and what are the problems.
Now, I've often said that HDR is sort of more important to improving picture quality than increasing the number of pixels on the screen. Would you agree?
Certainly, at this point, it is. Once you get up to HD, I mean, the jump to HD was very important for picture quality.
I agree. Yes.
But sure. Once you get up to HD and you go to UHD, it's diminishing returns. And UHD certainly is better than HD, but it's not radically better, I wouldn't say, particularly the way most people look at it. So high dynamic range does offer the potential to be something that really is radically better, but there's also a number of pitfalls. So I hope we get to talk about those today.
Oh, I'm sure we will. but I wanted to show people one slide from your presentation at that Samsung event that I thought was so cool, because really when we're talking about HDR or imaging in general, we have to keep in mind human visual perception, because that obviously, I mean, what we end up experiencing is based upon what the input is, the stimulus, if you will, but also how our brain processes things. So I would love to take a look at graphic number one and have you explain a little bit about what we're looking at here.
Certainly. This is actually one of the, I think, 3 points that I try to make that are really not intuitive and are necessary for understanding color imaging. And one of them is that many people think color is a physical property. They'll say the ball is red or the shirt is blue. And to a sense, that is true, but it's not entirely true, because if you take the red ball and the blue shirt and you walk under a sodium vapor light, they're both yellow. Okay. Mm. And so the light that you see the color with affects the color. And that's what this top figure is with all the patches. Some of you who work in the tech area of color probably have heard of something called a color checker, which is a chart that you can use to photograph that has a number of colors, which are represented here. And I'm not sure how well this shows up on the screens that people will have. But if you look at this on a calibrated display, you will definitely see that the top row colors are not quite the same as the bottom row colors, and that's because the top row colors are the colors you would see under tungsten, and the bottom ones are the ones you would see under daylight. So this is an actual physical change in the color that results from the illumination, not so much the object itself. Now, mm-hmm. the bottom one, which I think you probably can see on the screen because it's a little more dramatic, is that we don't really understand all of the color processing that goes on in the visual system. And this is an example of something that I don't think anybody knows why this happens. The letters in the both of the word chromatic and the word induction, and that's what the name of this phenomenon is are the same. They're 255-00 and sRGB. So they're pure red primary colors in 709. And yet, I think a lot of you, if you stand back a little from the screen, they won't look red. Now, if you have a minute, since I'm sitting here talking forever, go up to the screen and look at them really close, and I think you'll see that they are, in fact, red. But as you back up, they're no longer red. And this is just an example of some of the complexity of the human vision processing that also causes color to do unexpected things.
Yeah. Now, the word chromatic to me looks kind of more orange, and the word induction looks kind of almost magenta a little bit.
Yes. And actually, this will be different for different people.
Even more strange.
Yeah. So there was one, I showed this to a class one time that I was lecturing to, and there was one person in the class who says, they both look red to me. So I think it just depends on the processing in your brain. But most people will see those two words as different colors, at least if they stand back a bit.
Now, is this the same thing as that famous, is the dress blue and black or white and gold thing? You remember that? It was a year or two ago. There was that thing going around the internet with a picture of a dress from a catalog.
Uh-huh.
And some people swore that it was black and was blue with black accents, and other people swore it was white with gold accents. It was the same picture.
I don't think that was chromatic induction. I do think that was another visual processing effect, because there's a bunch of them. There's not just a few.
Yeah. I understand. But that was a famous one that sort of took the internet by storm for a while. There it is.
Yeah. Well, that was quick work.
Yeah. Thank you to Josh, our engineer. He knows what he's doing for sure.
So there's a number of these things, but the important thing to remember in all this is that it's perception. Color is perception. So you really can't think of color as being a physical property of an object. It is what you see.
And right, exactly.
That seems, somewhat esoteric and philosophical, but it actually has practical implications when you're designing imaging systems.
Right, such as the ones we are talking about today. Mm-hmm. The other graphic that I wanted to show right off the bat was something called color volume. And this becomes critically important for high dynamic range imaging. And let's take a look at that graphic and you can tell us what we're looking at here.
Certainly. So these are a representation of the color volume, which is sort of a way to express the amount of different colors that a display can produce. And the one on the left is a standard dynamic range 709, your garden variety HD display. And there it says the color volume is 118 million digital colors. And that you can see if you look closely again, make everybody get their exercise going to and from. That it doesn't go all the way down to the bottom because it doesn't have the darkest black. It only goes to a tenth of a lux or of a candela per square meter. Per square meter. And the top, of course, only goes to about 100. So that's what you end up with. And then the primaries are the 709 primaries.
What I want to make sure everybody understands is that within this weirdly shaped volume, which is a three-dimensional shape, that's the range of colors and brightnesses of those colors that a standard definition, a standard dynamic range TV or display can reproduce. And there are plenty of colors outside of that shape that we can see out in the world, but that TV or display can't reproduce them. It can only reproduce in that small little volume.
Yes, although the frame, the cube that the volume in it is in, doesn't represent anything other than the numbers.
It's just an axis, coordinate system.
The volume of what you can see is probably closer to the one on the right, which is coming pretty close to covering what you could see at least at one time with one state of adaptation. So, but to get back to the middle one is sort of the standard now for HDR. I don't know that this will change a lot, but people will get better at using it. But you can see that the volume is, you know, roughly four times the volume of the SDR. So you really have an enormously larger palette to work with when you're creating HDR than SDR. And the one on the right is the full 2020 gamut, the full 0 to 10,000 candelas per meter squared. So that's really, you know, as far as it will go, you know, that would be useful. I don't know how far we'll go from the second one to the third one. We may go a little ways. Mm. We may decide to stabilize on the second one. Excuse me.
We should say that, the one on the right there is sort of the theoretical maximum that the HDR system that we have developed or have developed up to this point anyway can go. Beyond that, things get too bright in a way. And as you say, that's about almost to the limit of what we can perceive visually anyway. So there's no point in going beyond it.
Right.
But to get from the middle one to the right one is quite a technical challenge, isn't it?
It is. And there are other factors to consider. Even if you could walk out and do it today without it costing an arm and a leg, it might not actually be something you'd want to do. Because if you look at the volumes, you know, the one on the left is roughly 100. The one in the middle is roughly 400. The one on the right is roughly, I don't know, 800 or 900. So you've gotten a factor of four increase going from the left to the middle. And you only get a factor of two increase going from the middle to the right. So you're really not gaining as much to take that extra step. And it could cost you a fortune. And then there's a question of would the content be prepared for it, which we'll get into.
Right, exactly. In fact, Emily the Strange is asking a question. So is HDR more reliant on the way the TV show or movie was shot, or is it just based on the hardware of the TV?
Well, you have to have both. You have to shoot it for HDR, although many things that have been shot actually were shot in a way that they could be made into HDR because, for example, anything that was shot on film, color negative film, has a very high dynamic range, and it has a lot of high dynamic range in the highlights. So you can go back and rescan the negatives and get HDR. So you actually do have a possibility to see some of your favorite old movies in HDR, and it would be real. With digital, it's a little, you have to do it a little more intentionally because the digital cameras saturate. But a lot of people, just for safety, tend to leave a little headroom in there, and it may be enough to do the HDR that you want to do. So you do have to be cognizant of it when you're shooting, and you need to not do something that would cause a problem when you're shooting. But it's mostly about the processing, the communication, and the display. And actually, the thing that is causing the most problem is the communication.
What do you mean by the communication?
Well, if I can show the next graphic, I need to make the point of the next graphic. Before, I think that will help with. So one of the other things that people sometimes don't know is that when you're taking a picture of something, a still picture, motion picture, video, the goal is actually not to make an accurate reproduction. Because people would think they were dull and boring most of the time. Mm-hmm. And you can almost always make it look a little better. And this is an example of a picture that I took out on the coast, where the one on the left, I did everything I could possibly do to make that accurate. So that is an accurate reproduction. The one on the right is using a typical technique to produce what I'll call a preferred reproduction, being preferred in that most people would rather have the one on the right on their TV than the one on the left, even though the one on the left is more accurate. Now, the problem is that when you're making these preferred reproductions, what you want to do depends on the display that you're going to, or on the dynamic range and the color gamut of the display mm-hmm. you're going to, because you can't expand it too far or it won't fit anymore. So
the display that you want to display it on won't be able to do it.
Right. So you have to sort of do this processing with the knowledge of where you're going. Now that we have HDR, we have two places we can go at least, and many people feel HDR is more than one thing. So, you know, but you've got one television broadcast unless you're using, you know, supplemental channels or something. So you're sending out a thing. What do you send? Do you send SDR? Do you send HDR? If it's HDR, how do you communicate it? What it was for, you know, in other words, what you were targeting for the display. So it's really important in the communication to be able to do all this. And the conventional television system never had to do this because all the displays were assumed to be basically a CRT reference display. And that was all anyone had to prepare for. And now you've got these multiple options. So this communication requires things that weren't available before, in addition to the display to display it.
Mm. So I think what you're talking about here really is metadata, information that's sent along with the video to sort of communicate, as you're saying, you know, what is the intention? Have I got that right?
If you could give it to me again, sorry.
Oh, sure. As I understand what you're saying, really what we're talking about is metadata. That is information that is sent along with the picture, the image information, that says how the image should be or was intended to be displayed.
Yes. Two ways to do it. And one way has two different branches. One way is to just send two streams, send an HDR stream and an SDR stream, and then you don't need it metadata, but then you have different channels for SDR and HDR.
Which means more bandwidth. You're taking up more bandwidth to send two whole copies of the program.
Exactly. And you have to make two copies of the program, which is a whole other issue. The other way is to send one version and metadata, and the metadata can either take the SDR and make it into HDR, or it can take the HDR and make it into SDR.
Hmm. Well, what about the fact, and this was one point I wanted to get to with you, is that, as you said, with SDR, standard dynamic range, everything was pretty standardized, so to speak. You know, the mastering display, the TVs in the homes were all assumed to behave the same. Mm-hmm. Now, with HDR, that assumption is no longer valid. The way that the display on which the content is created or mastered might have a certain set of capabilities, but the TVs, the HDR capable TVs at home or projectors or whatever, have many different capabilities. TV A will have one set of capabilities. TV B will have a different set of capabilities. And I don't see anytime soon that that's going to ever be standardized like SDR was. So how do you, even if you're just transporting or sending HDR, you need to somehow figure out a way to display it on a TV that may not have the same, probably doesn't have the same capabilities as the display that the content was created on.
Well, I think there is an attempt in HDR to try to come up with sort of a minimum display capability for HDR, which is what I plotted in the middle color volume figure. And I do think there's an effort to move in that direction. There may be a few TVs that go beyond it, but there are reasons not to do that, because then there's a question of, well, how can you use it? But the other reason is that it starts to get really bright and it starts to really drink up the juice. You know, I remember seeing a very bright mastering display one time where they actually had to run extra power into the building so they could plug this display in and use it. So,
wow.
It's non-trivial to make it just a whole lot brighter, and it's unclear if there's much advantage to doing that. So I actually do think that HDR will sort of converge around this minimum display capability. I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. But then you still have the SDR and the HDR programs. And so really, I think the bigger issue is more with how to deal with these two program streams and how to get them across and then mm-hmm. and sort them out. And the fact that actually in HDR, we have two systems that have been standardized in ITU. So, and those are different as well.
Oh, man. And we're going to get into that in just a second. First of all, there's another question or two here in the chat room. Emily the Strange, going back to the point about shooting or capturing images, she asked, do movies have to be shot using HDR equipment as well? And you made the point that digital cameras, you have to be a little careful. If you're shooting on film, yeah, you've sort of inherently got HDR and you can scan it in HDR and make it work. But with digital, so you have to be a little more careful. And we have to say that probably, well, vast majority of movies and probably even TV shows shot today are shot on digital, not on film.
That's true.
So they have to think about that. Now, the Sony cameras and some of the high-end digital cinema cameras and so on have 14, 15 stops of dynamic range, which is plenty for high dynamic range, isn't it?
Yes, the cameras can do it today. It's more the way you use the cameras. Sometime, you know, they'll have an ISO setting on the camera and you can turn it up to some ridiculously high number and then everything will be very grainy if you don't really use the top end. You basically clip the range of the camera way, way down, and so you have to keep the exposure up toward the top or it'll get really noisy. So it's not that it's an insurmountable problem to shoot in digital. In fact, as you say, almost everything nowadays is shot on digital, and I think that will even be more the case going forward.
Except for a few of those directors who insist on shooting on film mm-hmm. and have kept the last film manufacturing plant from Kodak operational.
Yes, I think they did that. I don't know how long they'll hold out on that. It's a nice mm-hmm. artistic choice. I have fond memories of film. I worked in film a long time ago. So I like film. I'm happy that it's still around, but I'm not sure how long it's going to hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'll just answer this one person that I was a fan of ELP a long time ago, and I took pictures of them.
Of ELP? You Emerson Lake?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm a big fan of them as well. Tarkus. Okay. Tarkus Imaging. Very good. Compi 386. Is that where you got the name of your company?
It's a long story, which probably wouldn't be interesting, but that is where the word originally came from.
Man. You know, that's good, Compi 386, because I was wondering that same thing myself, because I love that. I love Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Absolutely. Okay. I Am Special is asking, don't all colors go to white with enough brightness? And I will add to black as you decrease the brightness enough. As you can see in those color volume diagrams, that's really true. As you increase brightness, sooner or later, those colors are going to become desaturated and end up at white, aren't they? Or black.
Well, you'll notice that it's much flatter at the top than at the bottom. And that is because as you take away light, all colors go to black. That is absolutely a true statement. And so there is only one true black. But at the top end, that is actually a really big problem in current digital imaging processing because the visual system tends to maintain color to a very high degree. In other words, unless something is just incredibly bright, if it's a saturated color, it will remain a saturated color even as it gets incredibly bright. And that does not happen with digital cameras because they clip. So you'll clip one channel and then you'll clip two channels. And pretty soon, you know, you don't have any color left. All you've got is the one channel that's left. So digital cameras do tend to go to white. And you could actually design them so they wouldn't, but then they look weird. The highlights, you get pink clouds and weird colors in the bright objects that you don't want. So that is more an artifact of the capture, and also the displays do the same thing. So in this case, the capture and the displays are pretty well matched in that they both exhibit the same behavior. But film actually was closer to the eye in that you could photograph a fairly bright red light. Street lights are something that caused this problem in footage. So you're photographing street lights and it's a dark scene, so you open up the iris, and pretty soon the street lights all look white, which isn't really good for the traffic. So it's a problem that we've actually struggled with in various groups that I've worked on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted your thoughts for a moment on, since we were looking at this color volume, and we see that it offers artists, movie makers, TV content creators, a larger palette, more colors, greater range of brightness and darkness to work with. What will they do with that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there's a whole lot that can be done with it. And I think that there is a process of discovery going on where people are finding what they can do with it. Because I think the first assumption that people tend to make is that, well, I've got a high dynamic range display, so that means I can put a high dynamic range scene on it. But the fact of the matter is that most of the scenes, particularly the way they've been lit for years and years, aren't that high a dynamic range, unless they have a mixture of shadows and light areas, or they have something in them that's really bright, like the sun or something, or many other things. I think Kodak did a study back in the 50s where they measured a huge number of scenes, and they found out that the average dynamic range was about 160, which is no trouble to put on an SDR display.
Yeah.
Part of the problem, though, is that they also found that there was huge variability. They found a bunch of scenes that were like over 10,000 to 1 and under 20 to 1. So it's clear when you're looking all these and you have eyes that the human visual system is to some extent adapting to that. And that's one of the reasons that processing is necessary, you know, depending on the scenes. Because the picture I showed of the coast was a bit hazy, and so it looked a little flat, and part of that is just because of the haze, and then the visual system sort of tends to take that out. So if it looked more like the picture on the right when I was looking at it than it did the picture on the left, but that was because the visual system is basically taking out the haze. The point is, though, that you don't really need the high dynamic range so much for the scenes as you need it for other things. And one of the things you can do is, when you are expanding out the scenes to make them look better, usually there's a highlight and a shadow roll off. And with high dynamic range, you don't need to do that. You can let the highlights keep going up. You can let the shadows keep going down. And that gives you better highlight and shadow contrast, which is a noticeable improvement in the quality. And I think that improvement is really what people are thinking about. But there's other things you can do too. For example, all of a sudden, you can see outside the window when you're photographing an interior scene. So
I have to tell you, I've seen shots like that recently in the last year or two, say at NAB or places like that. And you have an interior scene and you're looking, and it's kind of dim and dark. And normally on a standard dynamic range set, if there's a window to the outside world that's bright out there, that's totally blown out. Totally. Mm-hmm. But on these HDR displays, you can actually see what it looks like out there as well as what it looks like inside. It's very impressive.
Yeah, and that's actually an interesting artistic tool, because it used to be, when people wanted to hide something in the shadows, they had to basically crush it. So there was just no shadow contrast, so you couldn't see it, because your eye could easily see the dynamic range of the display all at once. But with HDR, you can actually make something so bright that it'll keep you from seeing something that actually would be visible in the shadows if the bright thing wasn't there. In fact, you can like hold your hand up and block the bright thing, and you'll be able to see what's going on in the shadows. And that's been sort of a great artistic opportunity for increased realism, but it also is a great opportunity to see all sorts of stuff from the production you weren't supposed to see. So that requires a little extra care in the shooting too. That's something I didn't mention before.
Right. Right. I mean, I've seen that plenty of times in real life. If you've got some dark parts of what you're looking at and some light, really bright parts, the dark parts, you don't see much detail in them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, you know, that is, again, sort of in a way, HDR can almost be hyper real.
You could do exaggerations, and I think people are. And there is one more thing I'd like to mention, though, that I think is very useful for HDR, and it actually causes a lot of the problem when you're trying to make both SDR and HDR at the same time. And that is, with HDR, you can actually make dark scenes darker and retain the shadow detail, and you can make bright scenes brighter and retain the highlight detail. And so you can actually have your screen varying in luminance quite a bit more than you can with SDR. But the problem is, if you then try to compress that to SDR, you end up losing all the detail at the end. So that is actually one of the bigger opportunities of HDR, but also one of the bigger problems, because it almost requires separate masters.
Mm. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. First, though, I want to talk about you mentioned earlier that there were a couple of different formats of HDR, types of HDR, and I would love for you to talk about them and talk about what's the same about them and what's different about them.
Okay, well, there are...
actually, more than two, right?
Right. There are two standard communications formats. One of them is called PQ for perceptual quantization, and the other one is called HLG for hybrid log gamma, and mm-hmm. they adopt different philosophies. And before I say that, I'll also say that this is sort of a separate issue from the issue of having two streams, you know, an SDR and an HDR, and
exactly
whether you're going to expand one up or compress one down, and so on.
Right,
so,
which we're going to get to.
Hopefully.
Shortly.
And maybe yes. We'll even get to adapting for different viewing conditions if we have time. But
yeah, hopefully.
Concerning PQ and HLG, the philosophy of the HLG people was to sort of prescribe the whole system, sort of lock it down. And the nice thing about doing that is they prescribed how you're supposed to go from the scene colors to the encoded colors, and they prescribe how you're supposed to go from the encoded colors to the display colors, and they even prescribe how you're supposed to go for different displays to different display colors. And it's a very complete specification of what you're supposed to do, but it's also very restrictive, because that isn't how TV has worked. There is, for SDR, a specification of how the scene colors are supposed to relate to the encoded colors, and how the encoded colors are supposed to relate to the display colors. But people basically largely ignore the first of those. They basically create the colors on the display that they want, and then they send them around. And since all the SDR displays are roughly the same in their behavior, it doesn't just take a little difference to cause a problem. It takes a big difference to cause a problem. But HDR is a big difference. Anyway, so you send this around, these display colors around, and that's basically how it works. And that's sort of called a display-referred system, because what you're sending are the colors of the display. Now, HLG has been presented as a scene-referred system, and that basically they're saying these are the colors of the scene, and then they say what to do with them to get them on the display. And the problem with that is that there's really very little artistic choice in what you're going to see. It's sort of pre-described by whatever you photograph. So if you have to go in and change anything, you have to almost do it in the scene, other than making, you know, it lighter. You can do lightness and darkness with the iris or the exposure, but there's not a whole lot of creative control in the HLG system. And it's not clear if people will actually follow it, or it's not clear to me, I should say. There are many people who will argue the other side of this and say, well, it's perfectly clear, it says right here. And that's true. It does say right here, but the question is, will people do it? And with 709, people just didn't do it on the capture side. They did whatever they wanted on the capture side to make the colors on the display they wanted. So I don't know how that will work out. The look of HLG is also a little different than SDR, and I think we have some pictures. I don't know how well this is going to come out.
This is a good question, because for the most part, people aren't watching on high dynamic range displays. But I believe those are pictures number 4 and 5.
Right. So this is the HLG look, which actually looks pretty good on this display that I'm looking at here. But this display I'm looking at here is pretty saturated. And actually, one of the features of the HLG look is that it doesn't communicate a very saturated look. So let's look at the traditional just for comparison. Okay, so if you can sort of flip back and forth between those a couple of times, so you can sort of see the difference there. And you can decide for yourself which one you like. HLG was largely designed by the BBC. And, you know, having watched a number of BBC shows, I can sort of see this look reflected in some of their shows. So, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with the HLG look, but it is sort of different than what traditional SDR systems have made. And
yeah, it looks to me a little, the HLG look, I wouldn't say exactly brighter, maybe a little more contrasty.
Yes. In fact, what the HLG look does very simply is it leaves the scene colors alone and just increases the scene contrast. So the saturation stays as it was in the scene and the contrast is boosted, which I think gives you a look, you know, you see the contrast boost. And you don't see, in the traditional look, there's actually a boost of both the contrast and the saturation. And so you get this look here. So it's not clear to me, first of all, whether with HLG people will do what it says. If they do what it says, then the question is, what will the displays do? There may be some people who love the HLG look and want the display to do nothing, but there may be other people who say, well, this doesn't look like what I saw before with SDR. I don't want my HDR to look worse than my SDR, and they'll want the display to do something to it. So I'm not quite sure how all that's going to shake out either. That's another of the open questions.
Of which there are many in the land of HDR, right?
Yes.
All right, well, let's take a quick look at PQ then, and how does that differ from HLG? You said it was display referred as opposed to scene referred, which is HLG.
Yes. So with HLG, you're encoding the scene colors, and with PQ, there is no attempt to claim what the scene colors were. What PQ is an absolute encoding of the display colors, and that's actually another difference because HLG, the encoding is relative to the display black and white. So as the display black gets lighter, the picture gets lighter. As the display white gets lighter, the picture gets lighter. So there is not a single look that you will get. It will vary with what the display can do. And that is very similar to what happens with SDR. And that was one of the things that I think attract people to HLG is sort of a similar to SDR behavior in that regard. PQ is quite different, and it says you should make this color on your display regardless of what your display can do. And if your display can do it, it does it. And if your display can't do it, it's up to the display to figure out what to do, whether to clip or to compress or whatever. So the PQ is a much more absolute encoding of what's there and gives a very consistent appearance across PQ displays. And that's very attractive to another group of people who, you know, particularly the motion picture people who have gone to great lengths to prepare what they think is a beautiful picture, and they don't want it to be showing up different on everybody's displays. So they like the PQ, I think, or at least that's my impression.
Well, plus the fact that in terms of commercial presentation, we have Dolby Vision is the only high dynamic range commercial cinema system on the market, and that uses PQ. And at home we have Dolby Vision for the home, and we also have HDR10, which also uses PQ.
So
I think it seems to me that you're exactly right that the content creators, the movie studios and so on, are gravitating toward that because, as you say, they take great care to make the image look the way they want it to, and they want that to be as consistent as possible on the displays on which it is consumed.
Yes, and that is actually a dividing line that has been discussed in some groups that work on this, which is that the graded content would tend to be PQ and the ungraded content would tend to be HLG. In other words, like a live sports, possibly, you know, news, things of that nature, where there is not anybody grading the content. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work out, because again, you get into the trouble of communication, whereas you only get to broadcast one of them. So which one is it going to be?
Well, this actually gets to the question that you brought up a little earlier, which is, how do you, we are in a transition time right now. There are still plenty of SDR displays out there. A lot of program material is in SDR, but HDR is coming up. And how do you deal with the fact that they're both here right now? As you mentioned, do you make two separate streams, two separate programs? That's pretty expensive. Or do you make one and translate one into the other, transcode or convert one into the other? And where do you do that? Where's the best place to do that? I mean, there's a lot of questions here.
Well, I think it depends on the system. You know, one of the things that's also growing is internet viewing of content.
And with
internet viewing, it's actually not, I don't believe, I'm not an expert in this, but my understanding is it's not that big a deal to identify who's requesting it and give them what they need. So multiple streams is not a big deal. It's a big deal to the creator because he has to make them. You know, has to make more than one master, but it's not a big deal to the distributor at that point. But with broadcast, it's a big deal. With broadcast, unfortunately, also traditionally is not supported metadata. So you have the people who could do the metadata, the internet viewers, not really needing it, but maybe doing it just for storage reasons or something. And then you have the people who actually need the metadata not really able to support it. So it's a difficult problem. And actually, one of the things that HLG was attempting to address is this problem, because they tried to design their signal in such a way that it wouldn't be awful if you just viewed the HLG signal, the HDR HLG signal, on an SDR display. And actually, that's the last graphic. So if you can show the traditional graphic, which is the second to last, and then the last. So that's the traditional look again for reference. And the next slide is what you get if you send HLG HDR to an SDR display. And it doesn't look bad. This is a picture that makes it look better than it looks some of the time. But, you know, if you can we
toggle back and forth? Yeah.
It's a little flatter. You know, there's a little more compression in the highlights. But, you know, you can certainly see what's going on. And some people might think, well, hell, that's better than what I see on the airplane. So
that's a pretty low bar you're setting there.
You know, it's that is one of the things that was a design goal of HLG, is to make that possible.
Be backward compatible.
Yeah, to an extent. You know, they realize that it isn't like, you know, what you really want. And in fact, one of the big problems is that, well, once you do that, which do you optimize for? Because you could actually grade it so that the HLG HDR signal looked good on the SDR display and not so good on the HDR display. And we don't want that to happen either.
Oh, man. Or you could grade it to look good on an SDR display look good on an HDR display, and then it wouldn't look as good on an SDR display.
Absolutely. Particularly if you use the extremes. One of the things you really need to avoid if you want the backward compatible look to be okay is you need to keep most of the content in the middle, because you've got this compression at both ends. So if it's if you keep most of your subject matter in the mid-tone range, though, it doesn't look too bad.
But then it sort of defeats the purpose of high dynamic range.
Yeah, that's not something you want to do. So it's you know, are we having fun yet? That's the question.
That is the question, yes. A couple questions in the chat room, speaking of questions. Beatmaster is asking, have you compared BBC shows that are shown with HLG on their broadcast with versions of the same show that are released, say, on Amazon or something else that might do it in HDR 10?
I have watched BBC. I have not watched HLG broadcast. I've watched BBC shows that were delivered over the internet, which to me look like they're more or less following the HLG prescription. I think they're doing a little something. I don't think they're strictly scene referred, but they do tend, particularly with sport and so on, to more or less follow the prescription. So I don't know if that answers the question, though.
Well, just, you know, that kind of leads to a question related to a question I was going to ask, which is, how do they, you know, is there a way to compare them? I mean, I guess people, there must have been side-by-side demos where the same scene is shown with HLG versus HDR10 or Dolby Vision, HLG versus PQ, to see what the differences look like.
Yes, yeah, some, but not as many as you would think, because there's a lot of concern over cross-conversion of content. You know, there are a lot of movies that BBC might want to broadcast. And so, you know, I don't know. I'm just speculating. But I would think that that's true. And, you know, so I know that there is a lot of concern over cross-conversion. And so there's a lot of discussion about how to do the cross-conversion. In other words, should the cross-conversion go and try to make it look like HLG if it didn't? Or if you're starting out with HLG, when you go to PQ, should you try to make it look like it was done the other way? Should the TV try to do this somehow? That's a dilemma, and a lot of that isn't worked out because there isn't that much content. You know, basically, when I want to do a comparison, I just have to take a scene-referred image and process it myself. To do the comparison, that's how I made the ones that were on the graphics.
Okay. Let's see here. Got a couple other questions. Oh, I Am Special is asking, are we going to need new tuners for broadcast, HLG broadcast, say, or will digital HD tuners work? I think what he's really talking about here is ATSC 3.0, and I don't know how much you know about that.
You know, I haven't been keeping up on that. I know people who are working on that. So I don't want to try to answer that because of not having kept up on it. I want to say something incorrect.
Understood.
So I do think that the issue is recognized. I'll put it that way.
Sure. I had Rich Chernock on the show a couple months ago, I think now. He's one of the main guys working on ATSC, which stands for Advanced Television Systems Committee.
Yes.
ATSC 3.0, which is the next generation broadcast standard, which isn't even done yet. It's almost done. But it isn't quite done yet, and it's certainly not implemented. It's not in the field. Consumers can't buy a TV with that tuner or even an outboard tuner yet. Maybe we'll see something at CES. I don't know. Let's see. Emily the Strange is asking, do you think that HDR has applications in things like astronomy to see long, long distance things?
Well, that's a very interesting question because I went up to the Tetons for the eclipse and I had...
Oh, did you really? I'm so jealous.
Well, it was wonderful. But I had a little 6-inch reflector telescope with a Canon 5D on it. And boy, that totality was incredibly high dynamic range. I would have needed, you know, and I'm not even talking about when the sun disk is visible. Even after the solar disk was completely obscured, I would have needed 20 stops of dynamic range to capture the whole thing.
And wow.
So it was very interesting to me because I had not tried that before. I had seen one other solar eclipse and it was partly cloudy. And I didn't even really try to one other total solar eclipse. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't try to photograph it. This first one I tried to photograph, and I was amazed at how high a dynamic range it was. And, you know, wow. In astronomy, things range in brightness over just, you know, an astronomical range.
so to speak.
Yes. So, but usually the thing you're looking at is... you know, you're having to do long time exposures and so on. So they're already dealing with this to the extent they need. You don't need video of a galaxy that's, you know, a gazillion miles away because it's not moving very fast, at least not relatively. But
not relative. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so I think medical could be big, though. I think HDR could help medical.
Oh, there you go. How did your photos of the solar eclipse come out? I have to ask.
You know, I'll be happy to send some to you if you like.
I would.
I was happy with them. you know, as the being the first time I did it, I was happy with them.
Right.
I can think
just experimenting.
I would do more exposure bracketing if I had it to do again, so I could try to combine images to get that dynamic range I was talking
mm-hmm,
about.
Mm-hmm. Lukesh has an interesting question here. If Dolby Cinema has a peak brightness of 100 candelas per meter squared, or nits, which it does, roughly, like my Panasonic plasma, with a similar black level, why couldn't we display Dolby Vision on a standard dynamic range TV?
You could if it really has the black level. Which it may with the plasma. So
plasma might, yeah.
Yeah, actually, there or OLED can do it too. But
yeah,
there are opportunities to display HDR if you're in a dark viewing environment that don't really require that high of a brightness. But you do have to be in a dark viewing environment. And mm-hmm. and actually, that the other topic I was hoping to squeeze in here was
which we can.
Which is the adaptation for different viewing conditions, because people talk about making these incredibly bright displays, you know, more than 1,000 candelas per square meter.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think the real value in that would be to maintain the master in the brighter viewing condition. In other words, I wouldn't use it to make 4,000 candelas per meter square that you're going to view in your living room at night, because that's just going to hurt your eyes. I think yeah. that what you want to do is use that 4,000 so that you can look at it in the daytime with a window open, and it still looks good, because that's really where I think this high brightness is of more use than just trying to make bright things even brighter than 1,000. Because 1,000 in a dark viewing environment is really pretty bright.
It's really bright. I totally agree. And that's why I always say, or often say, that for me, I do most of my viewing in a dark room, basically mm-hmm. a black hole. I mean, I painted my theater Munsell Gray N5, I think. So it's mm-hmm. very dark and blocked all the windows. And, you know, it can be a black hole in there. And I don't need any more than an OLED. Which doesn't get as bright as these LCDs, these giant, bright 1,000 up to 2,000 nits these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need that in there. But if I had a big TV in a living room or, you know, some sort of room where I was having a sports party or something like that, I would want the LCD because of that added brightness.
Exactly, yes. And I actually... That's a very good question, though, because there is an opportunity with HDR to take TVs that just natively have a very good black level and a reasonable white level and display the content as HDR. I'm not quite sure what'll happen with that.
Mm. What about, have you spent much time looking at or thinking about taking SDR material and sort of expanding it into HDR? Because a lot of the TVs, the HDR TVs you can get today, will do that. And how much does it improve the image? To me, it does improve the image, but it looks a little fake.
Well, it depends entirely on how you do it and on what information you have. It is possible. If you capture the SDR very carefully, where you're using a knee for the highlight compression and you know what the knee is, you can take that out and it probably will work pretty good. But then you need metadata to tell you things like, well, I needed to make this bright scene lighter because now I've unrolled the knee. If you have knowledge of the capture conditions and the capture conditions were appropriate, in other words, you just didn't clip at white, and you have the metadata directing you how to expand it, I think it can work reasonably well. Of course, the same goes for capturing HDR and turning into SDR, and one could argue that it's easier to go from HDR to SDR than from SDR to HDR because you don't have some of the quantization worries that mm-hmm. you have going from small to large. So my inclination is that it's better to go from HDR to SDR. The problem is that if the preponderance of TVs are SDR, you're better off to send out the SDR signal with the metadata on what to do with that than to send the HDR signal with the metadata, because the TV may not understand the metadata.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is also addressed by HLG, as we talked about earlier, you mm-hmm. know, that if you send an HLG signal to an SDR TV, you'll get something reasonable,
yes.
Presumably.
Yeah, it depends on how picky you are. You know, I was...
Well, I'm pretty picky.
You know, I've talked with people, you know, and one of the frequent comments is, you know, that it'll look worse than the SDR, and why would anybody want to go to a system that makes things worse? When I say worse than SDR, I mean worse than if you had just graded the content for SDR, and it will. It will look worse than if you graded mm-hmm. the content for SDR. So I sort of hope that isn't what happens, because, you know, I don't want things to get worse. If they can't get better, leave them alone.
You and me both, brother.
So I just want, if it can't get better, leave it alone. But I think I do know that a lot of the purchasers of content, the broadcasters, are aware of this issue, at least some of them, and are starting to put into contracts where they buy something, you know, that you have to deliver SDR and HDR, you have to deliver only SDR. You know, they're saying what they want, and hopefully they'll broadcast it appropriately, and we won't have that problem.
Mm-hmm. In our communication before the show, you mentioned something called conservative HDR. What did you mean by that?
Well, that is the production of HDR content where you keep everything in the midtones. So that if you do just sort of compress it down to SDR, it looks reasonable.
Mm-hmm. So that would be one way to manage it. But again, you're not taking full advantage of what the new TVs or displays can reproduce.
Right.
And as much, anyway.
Yeah, and it's, again, there's always, whenever you try to co-optimize, there's trade-offs. And
always.
And the bigger the difference between HDR and SDR, which is fairly significant, you know, the co-optimization doesn't work that well. So you really do give up a lot of the creative possibilities of HDR when you try to co-optimize.
Are you familiar with, there's yet another HDR format that comes out of Technicolor. And from what I understand of it, it also tries to address the issue of delivery of a single stream to SDR and HDR TVs and giving them what they can use. Do you know anything about it, at least in general terms?
Well, my understanding from what I've heard, and don't quote me on this because, you know, this is an informal knowledge, but mm-hmm. is that they're taking the approach where they make the SDR stream with the metadata to convert it, you know, with the knowledge of the capture and the metadata to convert it to HDR. And so that's, I believe it's of that class.
Hmm. Okay. Lukash in the chat room is asking, when TV is broadcast in REC 2020 or BT 2020, that very wide color volume that we looked at the beginning of the show, what color would people with REC 709 TVs see? Could we reproduce accurate 709 when converting 2020 down to 709?
Well, 709 certainly fits within the 2020 gamut.
Big time, yeah.
Yeah, so there's no problem in terms of that. The problem is that if the content was prepared for the 2020 gamut, there may be colors outside of the 709 gamut in the content, and then something would have to be done with those colors. Either the whole saturation would have to be compressed, in other words, a desaturation, or you would have to do some clipping or some combination of the two. So if you just had 709 and you re-encoded it as 2020 and then sent it to a 709 TV, it'd be fine. Mm-hmm. The problem occurs if someone has actually tried to adapt the content for 2020.
Well, this also reminds me of the point you made a little earlier, and I agree with it 100%, that it's better to start with something larger and make it smaller than it is to start with something smaller and then try to expand it out to make it bigger.
Yes, that's generally, you're more likely to get in trouble expanding than compressing, although you actually can get into trouble both ways. So it's important to not think that one is easy and one is hard. They're both hard, but one can be, you know.
Do well anyway.
One can be closer to impossible than the other.
All right. Somebody earlier and I can't find it right now, had a question about bit depth. And we haven't really talked about bit depth at all. And that is, how many bits are used to represent the brightness of a given color? With standard dynamic range, it's 8 bits. With high dynamic range, it's at least 10 bits and can go up to 12, even up to 16, although there are very few displays and no consumer displays that can even do 12. They're kind of limited to 10 bits. How important is bit depth? I mean, it's critically important to HDR, but how far do you have to go?
Well, I would say 10 is the new 8. So basically, you know, if you want the quality you get with 8-bit SDR, you're going to need 10-bit HDR just because of the extra range. And if you go to 12-bit HDR, you're going to have quality more or less comparable to 10-bit SDR, which is generally considered quite good. So bit depth is an issue. It's not a huge issue. There are no straight conversions between bit depth and quality because of all the processing that goes on and the compression and the expansion and so on.
True. So, and how the curve as you go from dark to light. I mean, this could be a whole another show of, you know, how many bits do you need to encode a just noticeable difference in you know, can you see a difference between this brightness level and this brightness level? If so, then, you know, you need more bits in order to get that minimum difference down below what the human visual system can see. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole another topic unto itself, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And in fact, that was the design criterion for PQ, is they wanted to make sure that each, at 12 bits, that each level was as close to being, you know, just barely distinguishable by the smallest possible amount from each other level. And the idea being that that would be the maximum efficiency of the encoding. There's a caveat to all that, though, because that depends on your adaptation. I mean, we were talking earlier about how if you have something really bright, you can't see into the shadows. And you may have features that are, you know, 20 or 30 bits apart in the shadows that you can't see the difference between just because of the bright thing. So another design parameter of PQ is they wanted the just distinguishable difference to be under the best possible condition for distinguishing the difference. So it's sort of the litmus test of distinguishable differences. And I think they actually did a good job with that. When I saw that, I thought, some people are on their toes here.
Well, I'm hoping so.
Yeah.
We're talking about the next generation video system, which, as Joe Kane has said, you know, he hopes and expects it to be around a good long time. And PQ being referenced to an absolute value, as you pointed out earlier, goes all the way to 10,000 nits. We saw that in that color volume diagram. There are no displays that can go to 10,000 nits. Won't be for a long time. We have room to grow.
Maybe some of the outdoor signage. But,
oh, well, yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
But it's very bright and unnecessary, except unless you're wanting to watch your TV outside or something. So
Yeah, those big giant signs in Vegas, those probably get to 10,000 nits.
Maybe. I haven't measured them. Sounds like a reason to go to Vegas, I guess.
There you go. Maybe at CES, I'll take my light meter and go out on the strip and do some measurements. That sounds pretty interesting. Okay. Well, listen, it's been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much for being here and helping us to understand this brave new world of high dynamic range. There's a lot of questions yet to be answered. So maybe we'll get you back on in a little while when there are some more answers to all those questions, okay?
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun, and I suspect I've raised more questions than I've answered, but, you know, that's good. I think it's good if people know what's going on, so mm-hmm. I'm happy to do it.
Great. Now, your website, tarkusimaging.com, doesn't have much more than your contact information, so is it okay for people to send you questions?
Certainly. I mean, the email on that is just info@tarkusimaging.com. If people want to send me stuff, I will try to respond to it. I stay a little
bit. You're a busy guy. Yeah.
So I don't want to say no, because sometimes I get really good questions. And so I don't want to say no, but I want people to be very patient waiting for answers, because it may take a while. And you know, that's why there isn't much on the website, is because unfortunately or fortunately, I stay about as busy as I can be already. And that's so I'm not really trying to advertise. But I do appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about this stuff, because I think it's fun.
I do, too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here. You can always find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Eric Boulanger, founder and president, I guess you'd say, of the Bakery Audio Mastering Facility on the lot of Sony Pictures. We'll be talking about his work on many interesting projects, so I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.